Welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome back. Thanks for joining me for another episode. You know, many of us go through experiences that sometimes can leave us shaking, can leave us discombobulated, and we don't know how to sometimes handle it. And so sometimes we tend to bury it, ignore it, suppress it. But as we've addressed many times on different episodes in this podcast, well, suppressing or denying or just ignoring those emotions, those negative experiences, if we want to frame it that way. And this is not the best way to deal with these experiences and these emotions. So I've invited Jimmy Westerheim, the founder and director of The Human Aspect, to speak to this, as well as a number of other associated issues that are linked to addressing our emotions, our mental states. And so who is Jimmy? Well, at the age of 13, Jimmy sat in a tree and planned how he would take his own life. From that moment on, his challenges became both a burden and his superpower. His life took him on a journey around the world via sports, the Coast Guard, international shipping, and a number of stints with Doctors Without Borders. From there, well, he brought with him a wide range of experience, but continued to ask himself why mental health was never part of the conversation. From this, The Human Aspect and the Life Experience Library was born in 2016. As the founder of THA and lead interviewer, he has interviewed more than 750 people from all walks of life who share their challenges, how they overcame them, and how they learned along the way. He has led The Human Aspect from an idea to a global movement that aims to redefine mental health globally. Well, I welcome Jimmy to the show, and I hope you enjoy and take a lot from this extended interview. So let's slip into the stream and meet Jimmy Westerheim. Hey, welcome to the show, Jimmy. I was wondering if we could start by maybe you introducing yourself and telling us what you're about and what you do.
Yeah, you have a long time. No, of course I can. And like, I'm Jimmy Westerheim, as you said as well. So at the moment, I identify myself as the founder of The Human Aspect, but also, of course, the leader of the current team. So this is my life. You know, I'm having a lot of those conversations with a lot of people lately, like about work-life balance, work-life flow, as I call it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, for me, this is my life. This is just as much my private life sometimes, because I have friends here. Some of them were friends before. Some of them turned in friends over the last year. Mm. So a lot of the fun part of life happens in this office where you are recording right now. Yeah. And of course, a lot of my motivations in life is linked to what we do. So that's the biggest part of my identity right now. But of course, there was a journey to get here.
And I think it's that journey I want to understand, because, as you know, the focus of this podcast is about how do we show up to adversity? How do we face adversity? How do we build resilience? You know, we have some great words in English, such as tenacity and fortitude. And how do we build that? Because it's not about positive thinking and positive affirmations or thinking about unicorns and butterflies. I mean, I guess to some aspect it might be that. But more seriously, when we face up to adversity, well, experience, she is the best teacher, and it's how we show up to that experience and the meaning we give to that experience that determines how we move into the future, whether it's we engage or we disengage. And so maybe we could start where you think is the start of your journey, you know, where the turning point, the crossroads that sent you on this particular trajectory.
Of course, the start of my journey was probably before I was born. Like, my family moved from a bigger city in Trondheim, in the middle of the country. There were city people, there were big-minded people, you could call them, in Norway, and they weren't really fitting in that sense either, but they fitted in more in a big city like Trondheim. And then something happened that caused my grandmother to find a new man. And this man was from Hurum, like a tiny little place where, you know, it was like 500 people on this little area. So they moved there when my mom was like 13, 14, I think. And of course, this changes everything for them. Like I said, they were already a little bit different. They were more global-minded, you could say, than Norwegians in general. So then coming to an even smaller place obviously made it tough for them and for my mom. So I think, of course, a lot of them wanted to kind of move out from there and into the bigger world. They still had this mindset. And then suddenly I arrived, you know, as a surprise, unplanned, you could call it. And they weren't together like my mom and dad in this situation. So I then come into the world without a father, and he kind of didn't really want me to be his in that sense. Like he wished it wouldn't happen. He had some other kids with other women from before, and he kind of didn't necessarily need another one, to put it like that. Mm. So already from there was something off with the energy. Like, and if we look into the neuroscience of how babies are impacted with these things, I'm now linked to two things. I'm linked to, of course, my mom and my family maybe wanting away from this small place, but me arriving, changing that narrative. And then I have a father on the other side that doesn't want me. It's like, clearly impacts me. But I was lucky. I got a stepfather at the age of one, so obviously my first years I didn't even know that this wasn't my father. And today he is in all the purposes of the definition.
No, it's just not biological, but you know, it's the father. He was the caregiver. So, you know, the first one is just, he just kind of added the chemistry. And then the real father is the one that shows up and is still around, right?
Absolutely. Mm. And that's where he has absolutely been. So growing up with this, obviously, at one point, they are telling me, like, you have another one. Like, and this is the guy, and maybe he wasn't necessarily living the best life as well. He was struggling a little bit with alcohol and struggling more and more in that sense. But my mom felt that he had changed in a way. So I was introduced to him as kind of the weekend dad kind of solution, right? And again, my mindset was also a global mindset. I truly felt I didn't belong in this place, even though I loved the nature. I loved the ocean, which I was very fortunate to grow up next to. And I loved the tiny community of our family. We were fairly well connected, our family, in the beginning. And there were some younger kids. And, you know, it was a very cheerful upbringing in that sense. But I didn't feel like people understood me, especially my peers. So given the opportunity to explore another place, right, in the weekend, that sounds very intriguing. So for me, it was an adventure. I could start over. I could be someone new. I could maybe find some new friends. At least in my head, I thought so. Mm. So I think I kind of glorified it a little bit before I had even started it.
And what age were you roughly about this time?
It was like 7, somewhere around there.
Okay, just to put a pin in the map here.
Yeah. And to make a long story short, it ended up with me basically being there for a few years, from 7 to like 13. And I experienced quite traumatic events there, in the sense of the alcohol, a lot of being basically like not following up on these promises. It was a lot of strange conversations. There was a lot of strange behavior. And of course, some incidents that just basically impacted me in this traumatic sense.
And then we're just to fully understand, we're talking about your stepdad and when you moved in to
my biological father.
Your biological father. Okay. Yeah. Your biological father.
No, my stepdad and my mom, they're enjoying life together and had, like I said, like a fairly stable and very good home there.
Yes, your biological father at this point.
Okay. Exactly. So the weekend dad thing going on over there. The problem was that when all these traumatic events happened, you would think that I would just tell my mom and just stop going, right? It was an option. I didn't live there. But the problem was that I was struggling so much back home with fitting in, with heavy bullying, with not really enjoying life there at all. So even though it was very difficult inside the house with my dad and when he was around, my biological father, the problem was that I still enjoyed what was outside of the house. I felt I was a better version of myself. I had cooler friends. He lived right next to the biggest amusement park in the country. I had a younger brother that looked up to me, had an older sister that I could look up to. So like, there was reasons why I didn't want it to stop. And I knew if I told my mom about what was going on, she would have just like, you're not allowed to go, right? Done. Mm-hmm. So for some strange reason, I didn't. So now I kind of live in these two worlds, one maybe representing 10-15%, and the other one was this not fitting in, being bullied outside.
So we can already see the shaping of a narrative in your head where you're coming up with sort of counter arguments not to tell your mom. And so maybe at the time this was adaptive at some level, but we can already see, Jimmy, sort of the narrative you were telling yourself. And when we keep telling ourselves this, well, it becomes part of us.
Exactly. Plus, I didn't necessarily know it was wrong. Mm. I was a kid, right? Mm. So even when I grow older, and I'm getting like 12, 13 now, this is where I'm starting to make resistance. This is where I'm starting to realize that this isn't okay, and that maybe it's not worth it. So at 13, eventually I come one day, and they ask me, okay, you know, should we set up like driving over to your dad's? And I just say no. And then no more questions, nothing. And then that's the end of it. And then when I was 15, we have our, you know, communion in Norway, the confirmation. And then I invited him. Mm-hmm. Then it's like a while since I've seen him. And then he shows up 2 days late, like classic. This is like the definition of our relationship. Like he basically like giving you a promise and not keeping it. So I have fairly vivid memory of remembering him just showing up to the communion, like giving me a gift, and then me saying like thank you and goodbye, basically. And that was that. Mm-hmm. So I haven't physically seen him since then. But as you said, a lot when I'm talking outside, my story starts when I was 13. So 2 years before this, when I said no to go there.
Yeah.
I had just started what we call like upper secondary school in Norway, like ungdomsskolen.
Sure.
And I hoped it would get better because in the countryside, that means like more students will come in from other tiny little villages, right, to this school. So I'm thinking, great, new opportunity to get new friends, right? Mm-hmm. And it didn't end up like that at all. It potentially even got worse. I tried to be with the cool kids, the kids that made trouble. Didn't really work out. Mm-hmm. And my uncle started as a kind of the janitor and fix-it-all at the school. And just to give you a picture of how my situation was, normally you wouldn't kind of lean towards your uncle, your mom, or your dad at this point. But I ended up in a lot of the big recesses. I was sitting with him in his office instead of going outside. And I was a very active child, or teenager. And so that wasn't really...
In the sense of physically active. Yeah.
Physically active, chatty, extroverted, you can say, on one side.
Okay.
So I wasn't scared of talking to anybody. Mm-hmm. And even though I was quite heavily bullied, I was also accepted by quite a lot of people because of my athletic abilities. So for me, sitting there kind of tells you a lot. So it's a good example of showing how I didn't enjoy life at all at this point. I was just waiting for it to end. Basically, I was already now waiting for the next step in school life, which is in 3 years. And of course, in the age of 13, 3 years is a lifetime at this point.
It is. It is. So when you're saying, so you were looking actually already forward to the new chapter, even though this chapter had just begun.
Exactly. And this is where, in terms of lack of perspective at the age of 13, things start to become really gloomy. Because as well, I had expectations, right? And they weren't met. So quite early, I end up in a situation and this, you know, kind of famous event in my life that I was sitting, you know, in a tree contemplating about life. And I've done that a lot, but like in a more reflective, philosophical way, let's say. But this time it was more gloomy in the sense of I was now reflecting on how to end my life and not if to do it. It's just, I don't see... Like, it was a lifetime, as I said. I didn't even have expectations that in 3 years it will be better. No matter how much the people around me said that, the adults, it doesn't mean anything because I'm 13 years old. So for me, I had this situation with my dad. I didn't tell anyone. I just said no to go there. They didn't ask why. I didn't say. I was sitting now with my uncle. I didn't see any point in this.
And so just to put a pause on that, rewind a little, because I'd like to just explore that. because, you know, we've just come out of this post-pandemic. As you said, you're 13. The brain doesn't fully develop for another 10 years. You're 23, 24, right? And so your prefrontal cortex, this ability for you to reason and to understand, to process emotions, we weren't there. Yes, it's not saying a 13-year-old can't do it, but sometimes you need an adult, someone to talk through it, to explore what's going on. But it sounds like you didn't have those avenues or those opportunities into which you do this. And so you get wrapped up in the narrative, and that narrative, it doesn't escape the skull. It doesn't escape the bubble of your thinking. And there you are sitting in a tree, as I understand it, and you're contemplating.
What's the point?
What's the point? What's going on? And so, if I may ask, how far did you come in the planning? Was it just you had suicidal ideation? You were thinking about the act of, but had you planned out in detail?
Yeah. So I basically had a plan of doing it a week later. And my plan, I needed something that I didn't have in the countryside, so I had to then wait a week for it to happen and for no one to expect it, right? We didn't want anyone to expect it. So it's also important to say that I had a lot of those people around me, and I think this is an important point, but they didn't have the vocabulary, neither did I, to talk about these things. Like, they didn't necessarily as well see it. Maybe they saw something was off. But again, you never think that about your own child. Like, you would say, okay, maybe struggling, some bullying. I kept it away from them. So they basically saw, let's say, 30% of what actually happened. And if you take the situation with my dad on top of it, they saw 0% of that, right? So that's a factor. Another factor is that you would think, yep, he will be okay. Life is tough. You will grow. This is part of life. It will get better. And you try your best. And they really did. But at this point, as you say, this just becomes all-consuming in a perspectiveless mind of a 13-year-old. This was the only thing. And it was, in my mind, it was 3 more years of this and then a 10% chance that I would get better going to high school, right?
You were playing the odds.
It was really bad odds.
Yeah.
Like in the mind of a 13-year-old.
I think what's really important here is to understand that it's so important that at any age, especially teenagers, as they're going through this puberty, going through the change, I mean, there's a lot going on. We all know this. We've all been through it. But the idea is to understand social-emotional intelligence, to be aware, to increase the ability for us, the vibrancy or the articulation of different emotions. And not like most of us guys, mad, happy, sad, and then that's about it. No, there's a little more nuance to it, right? Yep. But, you know, it kind of hits my heartstrings to think of a 13-year-old stuck in a tree. He doesn't have the trust of his biological father. His parents or the caregivers around him mean well, but they don't have the skills for social-emotional intelligence to get you to articulate, to unbubble, to untether from these negative emotions and thoughts. And so what do they happen? As you said, they kind of ramp up. They create velocity, and it leads to this sort of unhelpful thinking, such as taking my life.
Yep. In my case, relieving them of me being part of the problem. Because kind of the top factor of everything on top of the iceberg here was that my mom got sick and she found out that she had, you know, potential cancer. Mm. It was like in the early stages. It was all good. She got an operation, but we didn't know that in the beginning, right?
Sure.
She was scared. She was stressed. There was a lot of attention now going to her, obviously. And I was in the middle of all of this at the same time. So I felt left out, and I felt that my mom, one of the few people that understood me at the time, or at least had the same mindset, this global mindset, right, it wasn't there to give me the attention. And then I felt I was annoying her as well. And some of the frustrations that she had probably of the situation seeped out on me. Like some silly things, you did something foolish or something dumb, as every teenager does. And it was an overreaction from her side. When I'm now overly vulnerable, you can multiply that by 10, right? Now I'm basically feeling like my mom doesn't like me or doesn't love me anymore, or like dramatizing things in my head on top of everything else, not feeling like anyone likes me, right? And as well, my grandfather was living there. So the dad of my biological father was living in the same small village or neighboring village. he had had some quarrels with my dad for many years, so they didn't properly talk. And my grandmother, she died when I was 11 from cancer. And the last 2-3 years, I didn't really see her that much. Mm-hmm. And she was a special person for me back then. So I also had a grandfather that rejected me, that didn't talk to me, that didn't invite me. So it was kind of the same narrative in different angles is now saying that this is the case. On the other side, I have my stepfather who became a father out of the blue. I had my step-grandfather that became a grandfather out of the blue. So I had both narratives. I had what you could say very fortunate events and very unfortunate events that created this like polarized...
Well, there's a dualism almost. Exactly. I mean, you know... You were in one village with your stepdad and your mom, and it was like light and what have you. And then you step into this other village, which is almost like night.
Yep.
I mean, it was like, it's like almost like the Stranger Things, you know, with going from one world to the underworld kind of thing, if I may use that.
Yep. So that was kind of what was going on in my mind, probably. Mm. Strong forces pulling two sides. Luckily, within this week, my grandmother, the one that I have tattooed on half my body, not her face, but like some of her lessons. She noticed something was off and was the first one to ask me the question of how are you doing with everything going on? Like, I didn't fully open up at all. I just opened up a little bit, but enough for me to postpone my plan. And that was probably what kind of saved me at the time. And that's where sports come.
In the next part of our conversation, Jimmy talks about how he shifted into the world of sports, where the only thing that was judged was his performance, and this is where he shined. You know, we could see an evolution in his narrative, but that his narrative was consistently linked to his performance, and that performance, well, that defined his self-worth. You know, sports and coaching became the crucible that began to shape his mindset towards a better direction. Sports and the world of sports was also an arena where Jimmy discovered his natural leadership skills and his abilities to motivate people. You know, he moved in this time between a victor mindset to more of a victor mindset. But with that, though, there was still some hanging doubts.
Because there was one place where no one really cares who you are, only what you do. And for me, this was perfect. Like, I have ADHD, meaning a lot of energy. Like, I'm athletically built and come from an athletic family. I had an immense need to prove myself subconsciously. I wasn't thinking about these things, but subconsciously to my dad, to my grandfather, all of these people who had kind of rejected me, but also all these friends and the people that were bullying me. So the motivational factor here, if you look in sports psychology, was extremely high. What you would recognize as well with other top athletes,
sure,
right,
sure,
at the time.
Sure.
So I go into this with my life on the stake, right? And I become good very quickly. And I become active everywhere and nowhere at the same time.
And what sport was it that you delved into?
Everything. But it was football basketball.
Okay.
That was the two biggest ones. So football, the biggest one. But football and basketball, I was very, very active and playing at that time, quite a good level.
And for an international, football is soccer in this case.
Yes.
Not the American football, too small of a town for American football. Yeah,
exactly.
Soccer. Okay, soccer and basketball, we're good.
Yeah. So to, again, make the story fast forward a little, then the next 3 years, I survive, and I will characterize that as well. I got a new best friend. He was immensely important, someone who understood me, someone that I could relate to when it came to the biological father situations. We really bonded over that. He had similar situations with his dad. We loved football and we spent an incredible amount of time together. So he was crucial for my survival the next 3 years. And then I came into Athletes College. I had that as my only goal in upper primary school, to get good enough grades to get into the school. In Norway, it's a system that you will always only get into the school that is closest to you. But if they don't have basically this program that you're applying for, you will get to the closest that has that program. And that was another school in the neighboring town, meaning I would get away from all the people that I grew up with, which was for me the answer, right?
It's an answer for a lot of us too.
Exactly. Yeah, so sure. I succeeded with that. I got in, started over. It's as simple and complex as that. Started over, things got a little bit better. Again, I went into athletes college, right? So, or athletes high school. So everyone is similar in the sense. You meet like-minded people that wants to kind of put their effort into becoming an athlete. So that suited me perfectly. I met people from, you know, larger parts of Norway, which is healthy in general, I think.
So can I ask you, so when you shifted into the world of sports, you had this one thing where, you know, you in a sense, you if maybe it's a lack of a better word, but you were kind of gifted. You had the physical traits to be able to compete at different sports. I was wondering, at that point, how was the narrative shifting in your head? What were you telling yourself? What were you identifying? And it's multiple questions, but I just want to kind of wrap it up in one thing. How did you feel it was affecting your self-confidence, your self-image of yourself?
Slowly, now, basically my performance was turning in like completely melted into my self-worth and self-confidence. If I was performing well, I probably could come off as someone that was fairly confident, someone that was fairly comfortable within his own football shoes or basketball sneakers. But if I didn't, I was completely worthless again. There was nothing in between. So it's quite a known element in psychology, right? That you completely immerse yourself in this and you're dependent on performances. So you very quickly become a perfectionist, as an example. Like you have to compete, you have to make everything perfect for it to work.
I think Carol Dweck, she wrote something called Mindset, and she talks about fixed and growth mindset. So you've gotten into sports, you got into performance, but you felt your self-worth was connected to that performance. And maybe it was game to game or period to period, whatever it was. And so if you did well, then you glowed. If you, in your eyes, didn't do so well, then you felt your worth would crash. Is that what I understand?
Yep.
So your sense of value was based upon your performance, these external
factors.
Yeah. Okay.
Or even, you know, I play team sports. So you're not just dependent on your own performance, right? You're even dependent on the performance of your entire team. So
yeah, but sometimes when we have a perfectionist type of things or we feel we're an imposter, I don't know if that came up, but sometimes people feel an imposter syndrome. So even though it's a team, they'll think, no, it's because of me, I failed.
Of course.
Everyone else did well. You know, you show compassion. Oh, he, you know, Jason, he kind of screwed up, but that's okay. That was just that game, but generally he's good. But when it came to yourself, it defined who you were over the long game. Mm.
But it also defined me here moving into it. Like the last year in upper secondary school, I had a teacher who came to me who kind of realized my motivations, I think. He realized that I wanted these grades to get into the school. And of course, I had two sports programs in upper secondary school. And he said, if you learn how to pass the ball and how to include others, you will get an A. In the end, he said it 2 years before I could have gotten it. It's like normal kids wouldn't even stick to that message,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
But I had such a clear goal, and I think he knew that. Mm. I've had a conversation with him many years after, and I don't think he understood the impact back then, but he had a huge impact on my mindset. And then, because before this, because I was bullied and excluded and all of that, I was very egotistic on the field. Like, I only focused on myself. I was the classic Ronaldo in his younger days, dribbling everybody, trying to score alone, not realizing that, like, there's 11 people, 10 people on the outside field in basketball, in football, and four other people in basketball, right? So when I realized that, I tapped into the power that I had and always probably had as someone people could follow, someone people could felt led by. So suddenly I started engaging even the people that was just, you know, everybody has those people in class that probably shouldn't be part of sports even because they don't like it. They don't want to be there. They feel bad.
Sure.
I, in some magical way, managed to get even them to enjoy it and managed to get them to be part of it. And he always, at least it felt like it, put me on the worser team. I still won. Like, I made it my absolute definition. And I was running around like a crazy person in the sense I had a very high stamina, which was basically my only talent at the time. Because I didn't really have a raw talent for sports. My mind was a raw talent for sports and my stamina, but nothing else really. And I trained so hard, and a lot harder and a lot more than everyone else in that sense, in that context, of course, again. And suddenly I realized the power of getting people with me and the power of motivation, which started to become very interesting for me now. So suddenly I was transformed from this like person that people bullied and this strange person no one really understood, that didn't drink, that wasn't part of the partying, it was just weird, to this person that for some reason when it was sports, I started becoming picked earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier when the cool kids start picking the team, right? And eventually I was picked first because of this power. And as well, I was known to be very tough. I remember this game where we were playing the teachers. You know, it's always the pupil against the teachers, right?
Sure, sure.
The coolest guy, Greg, he was like really fit, like the guy everybody looked up to when it came to sports.
The jock, yeah.
Exactly. And I basically went into a head, like a proper duel with him. And we went like really hardcore together. And I won the duel and he got physically injured. Like, and he was sent off. Back in the day, this was so cool, right? For the kids. Whoa, the coolest sports jock. You broke him in a duel, right? Yeah, and it was a fair duel as well. And we won the game, obviously. So that was kind of how I was transformed. And that's the personality that comes into now athletes high school. And I evolved basically very quickly, not to over-exaggerate in that sense. And for the first 2 years, I was taking the bus 2 hours each way, 4 hours a day. That says a lot. I get carsick. That shows you how much I wanted this and wanted to get away. And I trained incredibly high amount. Looking back at it now, I'm not even sure how I managed. Like I woke up, I went to bed at like 9:30, like the typical, that kind of mindset, right? And I woke up sometimes at 5 to train before I went on the bus. Mm-hmm. Other times I didn't, and I had 1 or 2 training sessions a day in school. And then I trained on the way home again.
So at this point, you know, your coach, he said something, what he thought was just what he'd tell most kids. But for you, it was a significant, it sent you again on a different trajectory. But before then, you were very ego-driven, perform. It was about me on the team, forget the team. Yep. But he said something to you, again, that changed you. So at this point, how would you describe your narrative you're telling yourself after the coach, after you performed, after you beat Greg, after you've been able to motivate team members, even if they weren't really geared or the worst team, as you said, but you geared them up to be the best team or the better team. What is your narrative at this point, Jimmy?
Now I'm starting to realize as well the power that I had. And I went slowly from more of a victim mindset, right? Feeling like life dealt me the wrong cards. Because to be fair, life dealt me the wrong cards in certain situations. But I'm starting now to feel that there's certain things I can impact that I didn't see. Like, for example, this didn't just change me on the field. It also changed me off the field. I went from someone that didn't really talk to that many people to someone who maybe stood up more for the people around me, cared more for the people around me, and was suddenly more outside of my own head, which made me a personality that suddenly started meaning things for people. Like, I've had people come to me later and said, you were important to me back there. You were part of my survival.
You were like that coach was to you.
Yeah.
For some
and
people.
Suddenly I supported some people and I took the hit for some people and kind of became a personality that was more about the team outside of the field as well. So it changed my personality. So the mindset that I come in with is that I'm having a little bit more value, but I have much higher expectations to myself right now. Now I am not just a good sports person. I'm the leader.
So experience shaped your expectations of yourself, broadened your experience. So if we just take a moment, what advice would you give to the listeners right now about facing experience? You know, something they may be dreading, something they're a little anxious about, worried, or completely terrified. What is it about experience that can help us shape our expectations? Maybe we could just discover that a little.
I think the first thing that I normally end up thinking about now is that it never makes sense until you're through it, right? So most experiences, when you head into them, they look difficult, dangerous. Oh, I don't want to do that. Then maybe you will choose some routes that kind of shortcuts you out of them. It can be drugs or escapes, or it could just be taking another choice, the not so difficult choice. Now I go to that school. This is too much for me, mm-hmm. right? Not believing in yourself in that sense.
The safe choice, maybe, in our heads as we see it.
Exactly.
Yes.
So for me, it's this society, we basically always have to measure things. We have to believe that we need to be up for the challenge. But, you know, the challenge is there for you to grow. So you will never be up for the challenge. That is at least the thing that have kind of taken me the furthest, probably, is that I've very rarely been scared, or if ever, of a challenge. Mm. Because for some strange reason, I wasn't scared of failing. Like Marianne Williamson says so famously, I think that fitted me really well, and it hit me really hard the first time I read it. Mm. We're not scared of being inadequate. We're basically, our biggest fear is that we're powerful beyond measure. It's what her beautiful poem is saying. Mm. That really hit me, because I wasn't scared of failing. I probably never was, because I knew where that was heading, and that was just medium plus A-okay, right? But I was really scared of admitting to myself the potential that I had. But my potential, not necessarily potential measured in societal context, but mm-hmm. like I said, I realized that in a sports context, I do not have the physical raw talent. I could have had more explosivity, I could have had bigger technical talent, all of these things. I didn't have that. But I had an incredible mentality, and I knew that, and I had a leadership talent. I was born with that, probably. And I had the ability to move an entire group of people, like a team, mm. based on my performance. Not necessarily what I told them, but what I did on the field. And that kind of showed me a different path in this. And it showed me that I need these kinds of challenges, or I'm not going to evolve that talent. If I don't evolve that talent, I'm never going to make it. Because then all these other people who have, and I was so upset with these people, you know, the people who had this raw talent, who trained half as much as you.
Yeah, I've met a lot of those people in my life. I've had to fight for everything I got, yeah.
Exactly. But yeah. I realized the power in the fight. Mm. I started being drawn to role models like, you know, Nelson Mandela, or sports famous celebrities that I knew came from a tough background. And I started realizing that it's very few people who came from a lighter background, let's say, that ever made it in anything. So I started realizing that maybe it's not that bad that I wasn't dealt all these great cards. Maybe that's exactly what I need.
Yeah, that's a perfect reframe. I mean, that's a reframe where you saw as like, you know, whatever fate has dealt me the worst card deck in this village. But with experience, you can reinterpret, you can change that story. And so just to stop there for a second, I think if we look at the cognition, if we understand it, it's your standards you set. The experiences that you had, as hard as they were, or as easy or as fulfilling or as gut-wrenching as they were, they shaped your expectations. And that allowed you, as you said, it broadened my experience, it broadened my perspective and outlook, and thus you were able to reset your standards. So I think one tool here is that we don't have to always just kind of stumble on it. Sometimes we can stop up today, this afternoon, and thinking, what are the standards I have for the job, or for my kids, or as a parent, or as a colleague, or as to myself? And actually just write them down. You can begin anywhere on the circle, but the question is, you can become cognizant of those standards. You went through an experience, but now you are much more cognizant of who you are now. But back then you didn't. And it was just through experience that shaped who you are, Jimmy, as I understand it. And another thing what I hear, which I think is really good, that more of us could adopt, is embracing the struggle. You know, sometimes the struggle sucks. It really sucks.
Most of the time it sucks.
But by getting into the mix, walking into the storm, we may get buffeted and bruised around, but we will come stronger out on the other end. We don't know what it's like, but I can understand how it can be daunting and scary and worrisome to go through that. Yep. But you don't have to go blindly into it, but you can take those educated steps. You can educate yourself about the process, But if you go and you embrace the struggle, you learn about yourself, and that can reset the standard, as you did, reframe the narrative, which one is much more healthier.
But of course, then again, most of this now I sound very reflected, right? This is me looking back at this time. So let me be clear about that. You know, I wasn't as clear about it back then, but in some shape or form, I understood that struggle wasn't only bad. That's where I was at that point. This is where I'm at today is more what we're talking about.
Hindsight always helps.
Definitely. But I was evolving in that sense. So I went through athletes high school. I did really well in the beginning. And then I got mononucleosis, this kissing disease, famous disease for athletes, the last year. And I had a shitstorm the last year talking about struggles. Like I just moved out and moved to this bigger city with my best friend. It was like hallelujah. It was like amazing finally moving out, because it was troublesome at home because I was too much big of a personality. I was traveling too much with the bus and all of that. And then I got that, and I basically had to try to kind of fend for myself. I had to work while the mom was sick, and I, of course, I couldn't participate in sports during this time, which for me was basically the biggest blow ever. And then I wasn't the best version of myself, maybe argued now with my best friend. And, you know, probably the best social year I've ever had, in the sense of feeling like I was connected to the people around me or my peers, which has been a huge struggle for me. But at the same time, most the difficult year I've had with all the other things going on at the same time. So it's a very dualistic year again. So I finished, and then, of course, had to put my athlete's career a little bit on hold, going into the army. And now, just to show you how not far I've gotten subconsciously, going into the army now, still very much something to prove. I had a bad year, right? Of course, when I was 18, I was signed up for the Special Forces. Clearly, again, I needed to prove myself. And especially since I'd been bullied my entire life for being the strange man. Like, on the sports field, I was someone people feared. Not in the sense of being a bad person, but being incredibly tough. I was that kid who broke that teacher because of just being tough. But at the same time, outside of the field, I was very in touch with my feminine sides. I've been raised by strong women my entire life, and I've been nurtured to be empathic and to be caring. And that was one of my biggest traits. So that's why I was bullied for. So I wanted now to prove to the world that I was a man, right? And that they were wrong. And what better place to do that than the Special Forces? Like, I've been raised with the same movies as everyone else, right?
Pulling a trigger, yeah.
Exactly. So going into this, I think I was willing to die to prove that I could get in into these trials. This is considered to be among probably the toughest trials in the whole world. Like, it's being compared to both the Navy SEALs and the Russian Special Forces. And it was a special thing. Let's say. So I went in there, and I became among the last two candidates. And I basically said no, that I didn't want to continue, because soldier's life wasn't for me. So I finished the whole trial, or part of the trial, the first part.
Sure.
And I said no. They sent me to another trial, which was then for the naval divers, like it's another Special Forces. Finished that trial, went from one to another one. And basically, once I finished that as well, I broke my ankle eventually, and I couldn't continue. And I was sent to be a rescue diver for the rest of my service.
Okay.
So I kind of had all these macho labels during this year, and I kind of got through all of them, cognitively realizing that I could do it, basically like pushing my limits like real heavily, and coming out of it not knowing what to do. Like, now I didn't have my sports career yet. I could restart it, but like, didn't fully understand. Didn't have a military career here. Didn't have a Coast Guard career, but it wasn't really for me. So what to do?
In the next part of a conversation, we jump a chapter in Jimmy's life where he studied shipping and he landed what was considered at that time a dream job with Global Ocean Shipping, where he moved to Singapore. and his life was occupied with the job and with coaching, and he loved the coaching. But then something happened, an injury, a hidden injury that showed itself one day when he was pushing himself hard in the area of sports. And it was a slip disc, and that required him to go under the knife. Now, they weren't too sure how the surgery was going to play out or what the results were going to be. And that left him with some nagging questions, which left him with, who am I now? He had felt he had lost his life in a lightning flash. Well, like with all experiences, good or bad, that experience can leave us with a lesson that we can learn, that we can take away. We just need to be cognizant of it. And in this case, Jimmy awoke to a realization that had been driving him all his life.
Study, 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 education, education. And I've been told my whole life, right? This is the road to nirvana. So I entered into private university, or basically community college, as it's called here, to study shipping. Because it was very in, and I just came from the ocean for 9 months. So I studied there for a year and now focused on the academic side. And it was a perfect school for me because I have ADHD. I don't read books, but if I understand the overall concept and if I'm engaged, I'm the best student.
You flourish.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly what happened this school. This was a school that was designed for people like me. So I really excelled. So when one of the biggest companies in the world came and asked the teacher, like, do you have any talented people here? We're growing. He named me and a couple of other people. And suddenly I was supposed to get 1 year in Norway and 2 years in Southampton to get my bachelor's degree. And suddenly I was offered a full-time job in the age of 21 with no connections to anything. This countryside boy that they hired in what is considered at the time to be one of the coolest companies on the planet. Like, we spoke about this company the entire year in school.
Okay.
And I couldn't believe my own.
So you won the jackpot. You won the lottery. You got this ideal dream job at 21.
Society's dream job.
Society's dream job.
Because that's an important
in Norway.
clarity in that sense, is that I'm still not sure that I wanted it. But I will get to the point of why I always chose that path.
Please, yeah.
Going into this, 6.5 years in this job, like excelling very quickly. It was a perfect company as well. They're the company that don't have time to teach you. They basically give you a lot of responsibility, and they kind of tell you, like, if you have a question, come ask. If you don't, do your job, right? It was perfect for me. I could grow myself. I could learn myself. I could prove myself, like, I grew so fast.
So you had to hit the ground running with this job, right?
Absolutely. And at the same time, I continued sports. I was the head coach of like a golden generation here in Norway, the 95 generation, and I truly enjoyed it. So my entire life was filled with sports and this job, and I had a girlfriend in between here as well. But my life was about these two things. So I hadn't given up on that. Now I've thought maybe I'm supposed to be the new Jose Mourinho, right? Like, coach, I had a huge talent. Everyone around me said that I was the youngest that did this, the youngest that did that. Our record was impeccable in those 3 years. And suddenly I thought that was maybe my way.
So again, we can see an evolution of how the narrative, your mindset is changing. From, you know, passing the special forces in two different categories and then getting this dream job at the time, or what the world or Norway considered a dream job at the time. And so we can see how this is, your mindset is evolving.
But still filling everything. Still, if you saw what I spent the most time with of the coaching job at the time and the shipping job, like a unique opportunity, the shipping job, I really must say, it was the coaching job. Right. And they even noticed that the company at the one point, so I had a strict conversation, I remember. But at the same time, I was so good at my job. So I was so youngly, cocky, confident in the sense that, you know, I knew that they didn't have anything on me in that sense. Like, I do my job better than everyone around me. What are you talking about? Like, if I want to spend a little bit time dealing with the coaching job while I'm in the office, like, that's none of your business, right? I was in that mindset.
Yeah, you were scoring performance-wise. You know, it's not about how many hours you clock, but it's about what you deliver, right?
Plus, I probably clocked more hours than them as well. So I was like,
okay,
I was the young guy, right?
My bad. Sorry, you clocked also the hours. Yeah.
But they felt it, and I can understand. Today I'm a leader, so I really understand, because it was about mentality. Basically, what they felt was that I wasn't prioritizing them, which was correct. So they were fair to say that. I just felt it was unfair at the time.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed my life going into this, living the dream life of everybody, like the American / Norwegian dream guy. And then coming into this, became an expat. I got the golden opportunity at the age of 26 and a half, even, I think. I hadn't even gone 27. Singapore, expat. You know, huge salary from someone coming from my side. And then, of course, going to Singapore, super exciting. Going there, first 6 months was tough to adapt culturally, but I managed. Coming back home for Christmas break, now I was thinking, okay, had a big chat with my boss here in Norway, and I was okay, now we're going to, like, performance. Now we're going to make it in Singapore. Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Come back, 2 days in, end up in the hospital. Like, again, like the first time, a couple of times I was short visits in the hospital in Singapore for other foolish things. But I had a big kind of probably a slit disc that I thought was just a strain in the beginning of December. I took it cool and then came back to Singapore straight into a tennis match, straight into a football game, because I was still playing at quite high level. Typical Jimmy, going from rest to like the second I have opportunity to be active again, I go all in. Hospital. With insane pain. I didn't understand what it was. Shooting pain from my back down to my leg. They thought I had broken my back first. Couldn't figure it out. Eventually found out that I had this slit disc probably for a month, and I basically destroyed the disc in this game. So it basically shattered inside my nervous
system. I can feel the pain right now. Across the room. Ouch. Yeah, okay.
So here I am, 43 hours into this hospital visit. Now I've gotten the message. I need emergency surgery. They're not sure what the result of that is going to be. They don't know if I will be fully able to function in terms of walking, running, jogging again. And, of course, they don't know what will happen to the pain or not. They think it will go away, but they don't know.
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting there. Now I've been deprived of my entire identity. Like, I am the sports guy, even though in shipping, everybody knew me as the sports guy. I had, you know, we had a visitor as well in shipping from a person who was on the junior national team in the cross-country skiing. It was one of the sons of someone important, right?
Yeah.
They came in and they were like, oh, Jimmy, no, haha, he was an intern. They were like, oh, no, you're not the most fit person in the office. Like, You can't say things like that to a personality like me back then, right? I made it my mission to destroy him, you know, and that's exactly what I did. You know, I brought him on like a training, all-around training session with me, and he ended up throwing up. And then the day after, we came into the office, everybody, okay, so how was it? But everyone knew.
So he was on your shit list, and you gunned after him, okay.
So he had to basically tell everybody in the office that he's the most fit person still in the office.
Okay.
But again, that just shows that I wasn't identified with my job. No one was like, oh, he's so great at his job, this and that. Like, performance-wise, I was, but that wasn't my identity. It's still sports. So when I was lost, I'm sitting now in Singapore in the age of 27 at the time, thinking, like, who am I without this? I have no idea. I didn't know if I could carry on with the job. I didn't know if I had to go back home from Singapore. It basically felt like I lost my entire life in a flash.
In a sense, you were rudderless after all this was kind of stripped away for you, at least temporarily, as at this point in your life, right? And that's how you saw it from that point.
Yep. And this is where I was challenged by a mentor of mine, where all these pieces comes into place. Because at this point, I didn't know that I was basically fueled by performance and that I didn't have self-worth. I didn't know at the time. So all the things we've talked about to this point, it was subconscious. I just touched upon it. I saw it from time to time, but I didn't know the connection. And he told me, like, do an exercise. He said, okay, go into your life, look at all the big choices you have made, reflect around the opportunities, the other options you had, and try to connect with why you chose the one you did. Basically, a choice analysis, or what to call it. I did that, and suddenly a pattern arose, and that was that I always chose the most difficult option, no matter what, no matter if I wanted it or not. I didn't even ask myself if I wanted it or not. It was never a question. I always chose the most difficult path. And then I was thinking, okay, I'm a competitive personality, but that isn't an explanation itself to why you would always do that. That's not motivation deep enough, right? I knew a lot about motivation at this time. I'd studied it, and I was kind of a big part of my life. And then I was like, wait a minute. I have subconsciously tried to get the attention of the people that didn't give it to me, even though others gave it to me. So like my grandfather and my father, the two masculine people that didn't give me attention, that it felt like I wasn't good enough for them. And I thought the way to become good enough was performance, right? And now I saw the clear connection. I was like, I've lived the life of someone else. Now I'm realizing I'm living the dream life of all my friends, the people that bullied me when I was in school and wrote me on Facebook saying they looked up to me and thought I was cool. So I had made it in the Hollywood sense of a movie, right? The American dream, but I was hollow. I literally didn't know who I was at this point. And that's where things kind of really changed, and where I was lucky enough to be stopped by the universe and have a time to reflect, because I needed to heal from this, obviously. So I was asked by my company if I wanted time off. Obviously said no, because I was scared of losing my job and scared of being seen as weak. And I carried on, even started working from the hospital bed after the surgery. Very successful surgery, lucky with that. But I had a huge path to walk, literally, to recover.
Full recovery, yeah.
Yeah. So I started, I very quickly got into a conflict with someone in my job because I wasn't at my best self. I'm 100% sure if it wasn't for the surgery and my situation, I wouldn't have gotten in that conflict. It was me exaggerating the situation, but there was a real reason why I acted out. So that escalated and I went into full victim mode. Like now it was the company against me. They didn't understand me. They were after me. They were not grateful for all the things I've done for the 6-7 years. Like my entire world got into like fight mode against them. And again, I'm the kind of personality that if you put me up into the wall and ask me to fight, I'm going to fight until I die. So I didn't care if it was a big company. I was already like calling up with lawyers and like I was ready to go to media and like all crazy, right? But for what, right? Eventually.
That's a very significant question. For what? Because it sounds like it comes back to you, the standard you have. Because as you said, I'd like to explore who this mentor is afterwards, but what you had said was you were judging, as I understand it again, please correct me, but I understand yourself was based on your outcome, on results. And you hadn't shifted the effort. It wasn't about effort was there. It sounds like if you had measured yourself in effort, you would have been in a much better mental space, in a better headspace. But it was constantly the result of your effort. But sometimes outcomes can be, you clearly know this, but just to put the equation here together, is that outcomes are completely, they can be changed by consequences beyond our control. You know, the universe and the planets can line up to screw our day up, right? Yep. And so then you're in the company, they put you against the wall, and you were coming out fighting, right?
Hard. And they didn't, again, I wasn't honest. In the same situation with my mom, with my, like, telling my family about my dad, they didn't know about that before I was 30 years old. So in the same here with the company, I painted the picture as happy as it could be. They didn't know about the identity crisis. They just know about this typical man way of explaining a surgery. Like I told them about the surgery. I told them what would happen. I told them I was fine. I told them I would deal with it. And again, they look at me as this machine, right? This guy who destroyed this like talented young ski star coming in, they believed me when I said that I will deal with this, like, don't worry about it. Mm. So they didn't know in what mental space I was. I didn't accept what mental space I was. And I lied to my family as well about how tough it was. Mm. I colored it as nicely as it could sound. I knew they couldn't come to Singapore. I knew they couldn't afford it. Like, there wasn't any point. I need to deal with this by myself. Mistake on one side, a lot of experience on the other side. So you could look at it in two ways. But eventually I woke up from my own victim mentality. Luckily for me, I was about to destroy my legacy in the sense of connecting to this company. I was about to destroy my reputation for this. And again, for what? So I ended up calling the big boss of the company because I had a very good relationship with him. And I was basically like honest and vulnerable. Mm. I was just like, what are we doing? Mm. Like, I've laid down. I know that you know this, that I've put down an incredible effort. You never expected me to be this good. You were just looking for cheap labor, mm. right? You saw the talent, but you knew I would be cheap. I gave you something else, mm. and I know you know that. And now it's time for us to move on. But we need to do this in a nice way. Mm. He took me on the word. He's a fantastic guy, and we cleared it up in like a couple of days. Like 3 months conflict, 2 days fixed.
Because yes, it was a good closure to the conflagration.
Yeah. So I carried on the rest of the year, supported them. We found a good way of like closing things off in a nice way for them to find replacements and all of that. And I could recover in peace without being an upset, angry victim mentality person, which is not healthy for recovery. So I recovered, but now I needed to find something to do, right? Because I closed this chapter and realized it wasn't for me. Like, it wasn't the life I wanted. So now I was thinking, all right, let's go for the opposite. So from the capitalistical realms of international shipping to Doctors Without Borders, saving the world, right? Like we most humans do. We go from left to right. I did exactly the same. And I applied there again. Performance was still there in that sense, and I wanted to get in. But first, I needed to do 12 months of studying. I had studied part-time leadership to get this bachelor's, because in my family, I would have been among the first to get the bachelor's. So it meant a lot to me.
Yeah, to get that university education. Yeah,
exactly. And I thought I would need it sometime in the future, you know. And leadership has always been a part of me, as I've explained. So I did that, applied for the Doctors Without Borders, kind of felt my life was changing and shifting. It was tough, but like I wanted this change. And I recovered slowly and in record time, mm-hmm. based on what they would expect. And then I was working on this process, and that's when I realized, like, wow, I'm holding a grudge against my dad that I haven't seen since I was 15 years old. I don't even know if he thinks I exist, like in his mind. Mm-hmm. But I'm holding this forgiveness against him because I think it's mine to own and it's mine to hurt him with, mm. right? And at the same time, I was speaking to other people about not being that kind of harsh, you know, being empathic, being the one who's cherishing, kind of overcoming things like that. So I was holding a double standards in that. And it was a tiny black hole inside me that was kind of eating up on me, and also controlling my decisions. Like, I always chose the difficult subconsciously because of this.
Yeah, well, what I find interesting, and again, correct me if I'm wrong here, Jimmy, because, you know, you have a very, as you said, a very strong empathic side, and that is because of strong women in your life, you know, caregivers. And then a lot of us as boys and teenagers growing up, you know, we sometimes don't take in the significance that father figures play into our lives and how much we look up, whether they are a stepfather or biological father, whatever that caregiver is, and that becomes part of our narrative. Obviously, this sheet, your biological father, his lack of being connected with you in that sense shaped you, and so all that empathy that showed up when you could build teams and you can motivate people, that's part of empathy. But you can also see how you're so performance driven and focused on the outcome, and that can be a very if I may be black and white, a very masculine, male-dominated type of thinking. And so that lack you had, at least that's the connection I'm making now in our conversation, that drive to prove yourself military-wise, business-wise, what-have-you-wise, it was driven by... It's quite a salient point you've just made. It's just something I just wanted to kind of nail there. I don't know if I'm off there, but that's kind of what my brain's kind of picking up right now.
Yeah, well, something like that. And now I realized I needed to do something that was probably the scariest things I've ever done, which was forgiving him and meaning it. Like, for me, I realized suddenly it's probably put on a wall somewhere in an Instagram quote, but forgiveness, okay. You know, forgiveness is for you.
Not all. Exactly, yeah.
It was never for the other person, because I needed to let go, right? And suddenly I was ready, because my mind has always been logical. I'm a person with an opinionated person with a strong personality, so... I can be very strong in my opinions, but once I have been given the opportunity to learn something new and for it to sink in, I can change that opinionated strong opinion, right? So I realized that I need to do this. So first I found his number, sent him an SMS, no reply, sent him another SMS, no reply. So on the way home on the Norwegian winter's night, cold and snowy and icy, it's like the perfect Hollywood moment. I call my dad that I haven't spoken to in 12 years on the phone. And I say, hello, it's Jimmy Rubin. He's like, Jimmy Rubin who? And for the ones who don't follow the statistics, I'm the only one. Then I was like, your son. And it was very quiet on the other side of the phone, I can say that. And then I had a very strange conversation for the next 20 minutes. I basically told him about my life. And for the listeners that have listened for 1 hour now, you realize that that's difficult to tell my strange life in 20 minutes. And I basically told him I forgave him for the things that he had exposed me for and what he had done to me, but also to my younger brother and to my older brother and to everyone around him, basically. And that I wanted to let that go. So that was an incredible feeling. And at the same time, I got confirmed that he hadn't necessarily moved so far into his life. The way he responded was exactly what I remembered. It was creepy. It was like I saw him yesterday. It was the same feelings. It was the same kind of responses. And it helped me realize that this was the right thing to do. Like, this man... is a donor. This man has been an important part of my story. If I didn't have him, let's say that my stepdad was my biological father and I had this preacher perfect home, like at least in my closest family, I wouldn't have worked as hard. I wouldn't have had anything to prove. I would have not had this deep motivation that got me to where I was. And suddenly I appreciated that. And that changed things, because it's one thing to forgive him and say what has happened, it's behind me, I've dealt with it. That you can do, but the strongest power for me was realizing that it was positive. I'm not saying I would wish it on, let's say, my children, if I ever get children, or my best friends or anyone else, because it was tough. But I realized that without it, I wouldn't be where I was, right?
The experience allowed you to reappraise, to give new meaning to the situation. You flipped it on its head, so it served you. And so it sounds like the catalyst to that was your insight. You know what? I'm just going to apologize to this. Forgive him, sorry. Not to apologize, but to forgive him for what have you.
Apologized.
Yeah, sorry. For you to forgive him. But in a sense, that allowed you to make peace with your past.
And I actually made peace. Because there's a lot about talking about that, right? Mm. And it's something reading about it in a book, or 1, 2, 3, forgive someone. But it's something else to do it. When I hung up the phone and I heard, a little bit about his life, and I kind of realized it was the same, I realized that I had actually succeeded. Like, it was probably my biggest achievement in life up to that point. Like, I literally succeeded in forgiving a person that I've had a grudge against my entire life. And I also, on top of it, managed to see the positive in what I saw as a dark part of my history, that at this point, he was the only one who knew. I hadn't told anyone about the things that had happened. And I was like, success, right? And I felt so much lighter after that. I went into a completely different energy and felt relieved.
In the next part of our conversation, Jimmy talks about his stint with that noble organization, Doctors Without Borders. And his first assignment? Well, it was Afghanistan. Now, we all have a narrative of what Afghanistan is, but what was interesting about Jimmy is that he went in with curiosity, a hunger to learn, and to question that narrative that we in the West constantly hear about countries such as Afghanistan. And it was an interesting gig for him. But at some point, the Kandahar Hospital was bombed, and it was bombed by the Allies. In that horrible tragedy, Jimmy lost friends, he lost colleagues. And I'll let him tell the story, but within that chaos was the birth of the idea for the human aspect. Now, as Jimmy says, why don't we make a place where we can learn from the experiences that we've had, and to learn from the power of experience?
So they're calling me from Doctors Without Borders, and I was on the train just to show you a little bit the mentality that I'm in as well, that I'm quite known for. And they're telling me, okay, you're approved and we found a mission for you. It's a very big, challenging mission. We have never had anyone this young before in this position, but because of your strong professional background, we want to test you in this. So you're going to Afghanistan and you're going there for a year, and you're going there to raise the level and be like flying support, that's the call. So the focus is that they wanted to raise the level and change the strategy in Afghanistan. They were having some problems, was what they were trying to say. I think I spent 3 seconds before I said yes. And she was like, you can think about it, you know, you don't have to come back now. And I was like, no, it's fine.
You're good to go.
I'm good. The combination of that is, number one, I've always been in the faith of believing in the universe, in the sense that my grandmother and my mom and people have been very like, the things that will happen to you are some meant to be, in a way.
Okay.
So I've kind of had that as my underlying belief system. So I'm not scared of opportunities, let's say. And I don't linger in overthinking them either. I evaluate and do analysis and all of that, but like the yes part comes quick. And then I start thinking. So I did the same. I
said, kind yes. of your intuition decides, and then the thinking comes after, as you said.
Yeah, and I'm also scared that I could have said no. Like if I started working in the company in Golden Ocean back in the day, 2 weeks, and then I wanted to go back to school, I could have done that. So I always know there's a retreat, right, in this the same. If I said yes to the mission in Afghanistan in 2 weeks, if I don't want, I can say no again. Mm. So I always knew that as an opportunity. So said yes, called my mom. There was a little bit longer process there to convince her that this was a good idea, must admit. But she also kind of trusts the process, and she knows that she can never change my mind anyway, so there's no point trying. So Afghanistan next, quite quickly as well, that which is also very typical of me. Like I normally don't get long breaks. It's like normally like straight out. So I go to Afghanistan. And I very clearly see this as my new path, right? But I also wanted to now challenge my mind in the same way I did when I traveled to North Korea just on a visit. So Afghanistan, North Korea, they're very stigmatized, stereotypical countries in the sense of what we know about them here. Mm-hmm. Like the narrative that we are fed in the Western world is very black and white, right? It's the Taliban. It's the people who hosted Al-Qaeda. It's a country at war. The allied forces are there to protect the people. Mm. It's very black and white. So I wanted to come with a fairly open mind to this country. First and foremost, because I want to learn. I'm a curious person. But also, I know that these narratives are just a narrative. Like, things is not black and white. Come there. Huge challenge. Again, I'm the young person. I'm in this position. I'm very quickly met after giving some suggestions and ideas and being very eager, like, oh, so lots of things I could change. I've been there a couple of days. I remember one of the people quite high up in the situation, like, really put me to my place. And I'm a really bad person to put to my place because I don't fold in those situations. So I had an argument with him, and I basically told them that I realized that, you know, I need to stick around to understand that that's not what I'm saying, but I can't help it. Ideas coming. So I just share them. I understand that it's not that black and white, but still don't cut me down and just talk to me like I'm a child. Yeah, I'm younger than you, but my professional background is very strong. My performance is very strong. Do not talk to me like a child. And I was very strict back as well. And once that conflict was settled, the kind of they started giving me a lot of respect because they saw as well that I approached it in a way that was wholeheartedly, which is kind of typical of me in this sense, because now I didn't have the football team. I was in Afghanistan. It was only that job. So I went it all in, right? And there's not much you could do. You're, because of the security context, you're kind of closed in. So I really invested in this job and found it incredibly interesting and very challenging. But again, I remember the first week, similar to the first week of Golden Ocean, and the first week of many other things I've done, which is have been over my head. If you had just looked at my CV and done an objective analysis, and you looked at the job prescription or description, you would have been like, nah, this is not going to work out.
Swim or drown, right? And exactly. It looked more like drowning.
Exactly. Mm. But I have had a fascinating tendency to be okay in that context, to be okay with not having the skills to deal with the job and trusting that I will figure it out and that I will learn very quickly, because I've always learned or known that I learn very fast. I can get from zero to, let's say, 50% incredibly fast.
Yeah.
And then I've kind of spent much longer on the next 50%, like anyone else. So I trusted that. I stood in this job, like really felt like a kid. And I'm using that phrase to kind of show the point. Like, I'm here with super experienced people that have been in several field missions. Afghanistan is considered to be one of the most complex contexts with maybe like four or five other countries in the world. So this is the elite that is there within this organization. I am nobody in this. And I love being nobody and proving people wrong, right? So I focused on doing my job. I tried to learn. I tried to be humble, but still, you know, forward-leaning enough to dare to have my own opinion and say. And after a while, I managed to get into this, and I felt really respected, especially among the national staff. They felt I was invested, and they probably felt more invested in than a lot of the people that have been there before, because I was very curious about their culture and learned. And because I didn't have this black and white mindset, I think I asked different questions, and they felt more seen. That's what they have told me after.
So the colleagues you're speaking of, they were actually Afghan and not Westerners? Yeah, okay. Yeah,
most of them. The ones I was supposed to train were Afghans, right? And then, of course, some of the other people were internationals as well. But I worked mainly closely with the Afghans, which for me was fantastic, right? And I traveled around the country. And then, of course, comes this infamous night of the Kunduz hospital bombing. We went to bed. We had worked the whole week ahead. Like, one guy was on vacation, another guy was traveling. So suddenly I was in charge of basically like the whole supply department alone. It's normally a position of three. And it was broke out a war in this northern city of Kunduz in Afghanistan. And then, of course, the Taliban went into the city and basically took over the city from the Allied forces. So it was full-on dogfighting in the city and bombing and shooting and planes and all kinds of things going on. We were the only hospital that was there. Every other organization left. UN left, ICRC, everybody left. We were there. So typical MSF, right? This is what they're known for. So I work basically 24/7 with my team to supply this hospital with the supplies to be able to deal with this. They're basically going from like, you know, 10, 15 clients a day to like 150 overnight. So a huge pressure. Loved it, right? This is what I enjoy. even though it's tough, it was fun in that sense. And we did a great job. I did all kinds of things that is brilliant stories for another day.
Yeah.
But the point was, I was in my A game, right? And we felt we were important. You know, in an organization where doctors are glorified as the heroes, right? Mm. The logisticians or the supply or the procurement, they're nobody, right? Mm. Suddenly we were important, and you could see it in the team. This was team building again, and it worked. And then we go to bed, and we wake up in the middle of the night with the message of the hospitals being bombed. Mm. Like, literally, people are dying. Your colleagues are dying. Mm. And I was also supposed to have been there because we were to kind of, because they were working so much, we were to rotate. And I was one of the people on the rotation list. And it was just fortunate that I wasn't there in the actual event. Don't know how that would have ended, right? So most likely it would have been fine.
You're just fortuitous that you were wherever at your dorm or what have you during the event. Okay.
So then this goes through, and then, of course, we lost 43 people that night, and it was extremely chaotic. Mm-hmm. I remember, because of the time difference, you know, we're earlier up than Norway. So after waking up in the morning, I was the one who had to go to tell all my team that has worked to supply this hospital that everything is finished, right? Mm-hmm. The hospital is smashed to pieces, mm-hmm. like, people have died. You probably know these people. I knew some of them, but I'm fresh, right? Some of these people might be their cousin for all I know. I didn't have the details for that. So I'm coming there. I remember standing in front there in the early morning in Kabul, then this main warehouse we have, and in front of these people that have worked tirelessly, my team, right? Mm. And these grown Afghan men, you know, very stereotypical in the sense of being tough, right? And maybe not showing that much emotions, and telling them this because they didn't know. And I knew that. And then just seeing how their faces changed was very traumatic in that sense for me. But also, again, assuring me that this is the role I'm supposed to have. It was natural for me to take that role, even though I was young. I was an international. Mm. I wasn't even in that position. I just had it because the other guy was out.
Circumstance, right, yeah.
But it was so natural at the same time. So it rose to the occasion in that sense. And then remember once telling them, you know, there were some tears there. They were struggling with this. We told them to go home, find out if their family, a lot of them had family in this area, like, deal with that. Like, take your time. We will let you know once we need you to work again, but not now. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I was sitting on top of a huge pile of these, like, what's called the paller in Norwegian, like these wooden things you put stuff on.
For the shipping, right? Yeah.
So sitting on top of that alone, and now is where I realized that on VG, like the big national newspaper in Norway, this was the headline. Like, hospital, MSF, bombed, people killed. Like, my parents, my friends, right?
Yeah.
They don't know if I'm alive or not. Mm. So I'm like, okay, they haven't woken up yet. So I was sitting there, and I remember calling back home, and it was my dad or my stepdad,
Your stepdad, yeah.
Picked up. That was a tough conversation of explaining to them that I'm going to stay, like I'm not coming home, which of course was the first message. Number one, they're happy that I'm alive. But number two, like, come home. And this was, I still had like 7-8 months left. And I was like, no, I'm staying. Like, it feels natural for me to stay. I can't leave them now, right? This, I'm invested in this. And we felt so much more connected after that. But at the same time, now comes the reason why the human aspect started. The idea, at least. For the following days, very traumatic. We worked on getting information, figuring out who is dead, who is injured, where are our people. Like, I was part of that work in the management team, the crisis team who worked with that. And also, very quickly, we got a support team psychologist coming from the HQ to support us, right? The ones in it. We were robbed from one truth, that is, you're safe if you work for a hospital and you have the white shirt, right? You don't need a bulletproof vest because you're a doctor. Taliban respect you, Allied forces.
Those rules went out the window.
in this moment. You can't trust that. I don't care anyone who said that. We knew it was not right, right? So it changed. The entire place changed. And then we did something fascinating. We sent out a questionnaire to all the national staff. It's like close to 3,000 people. And we asked them, because of the situation, we understand you've been taking away your security and your truth. Like, we understand if you want to quit. We can facilitate that and give you like a package. Let us know if you want to continue or not. 100% of close to 3,000 people said no. 100%, not 98, not 95, 100%. And I remember in that moment, like, realizing that this is why I'm going to stay. Like, I'm not sure this would have happened in Norway, if you understand. Like, I'm in this country now where we have been portrayed the picture in Norway that they're conservative, that they don't have good values, they don't appreciate women. They, like, all of these things are also true. Don't get me wrong, in certain elements. But in this situation, they were better than us. Like, a lot of the international people wanted to go home. None of the national staff wanted to quit. There's probably many other reasons as well, but I was impressed.
Well, that is a very impressive, you know, the Afghans probably didn't have anywhere to go and they wanted to the country.
Contribute.
And I think, you know, if we reflected back on Norway back in the Second World War, I think you found the same mentality amongst your own countrymen. You know, they went to war against the Nazis and the occupying forces in a sense, and they were trying to help each other. So you can see when certain variables are played into things that it can bring the best out of people. In this case, if we bring it back to Afghanistan, it brought the best out of these 3,000 people working for 100%. This organization.
100%. And then, you know, because of the international regulations, the international people were taken out first, evacuated. Mm-hmm. We're not allowed to evacuate national staff because if you evacuate them, you need to evacuate their family and so on and so on. So suddenly it's like 2,000 people you have to, and you're not allowed. So it's just a rule. Mm-hmm. Felt unfair at the time, believe me, but it's a rule. So international people flown out, national people guided by us to safely get out in their own methods. This is 6 hours away, so it's a big trip.
Yeah.
So the international people comes first, and then the national people will come in hordes after that. And then I remember when most of the national people that was there that night had arrived to the HQ, and they were sitting in this huge like basement dungeon. And I remember the first time the international people came down the stairs, I was in the corner, when they saw each other for the first time since that night. So it was like 40 hours or something since this happened.
Okay.
It went from very depressive mood in this basement to when they saw each other, you would have thought it was a wedding. Mm-hmm. Like, people were smiling and happy and hugging because no one at this point knew who was alive and who was not, right? Mm. And then suddenly it changed again because now they want answers. Their truth was taken away from them. They were angry. Like, why did they bomb the hospital? The Allied forces, not Taliban, right? It goes against your truth. And then our big leader comes down and he's like trying to give answers, right? But you could see he didn't have any answers himself. He was just as baffled as them and as angry as them. He was very emotional and he was dealing with it in a good fashion at the time. At least I think so. And then one of the lead, like, elderly people of the national Afghans stood up. Mm. In this society, then everyone else is quiet, you know. He was a respected man, surgeon. And you could see that something would need to happen. Our leader was about to lose control because people were upset and they were angry. And he said, if I were in the room with the general responsible for this right now and I needed to do surgery on him, I would have done it, he said. And then he sat back down. Mm-hmm. Just pointing the statement of saying, we were there doing what we believe in, the doctors, you know, kind of values.
Yes.
And that's why we're here. Let's not forget about it. We're all upset. We all lost friends. This was a man who lost his best friend. He tried to save his life of his best friend on an office desk in the middle of this chaos. And he failed. again, says a lot. Like, these are the Hollywood kind
so
of
So when
story.
The Afghan elder, the surgeon, stood up, said a clear, simple, but deep statement, that was like a clear bell that kind of cleared up all the noise and said, okay. And that kind of reframed the purpose, or reframed why everyone was there. In very simple terms, I speak.
It helped them to just realize that we're upset, we're angry, we're all looking for answers, and we don't have them. Right. Mm-hmm. This was a shitty situation in war.
Like, so it addressed the emotions, and by addressing the emotions, it calmed down the room, how many people were there, but it did, it addressed emotions. It was a one way to process, but in a very elegant statement.
It and again, kinda, very fascinating. It got me standing in the corner, being a Norwegian, coming from, you know, the best world, like really saying that with what is called clamor in that sense, and questioning if I could do that myself ever. Could I have said that in that situation? Don't know. Maybe not. And suddenly you realize that, you know, my black and white narrative was truly shaken. And it was very healthy at the time. Not that I was very black and white from before, but this was really proving to me that human beings and their value is based on that individual. You can't label a country or a people or whatever we do. So it was very nice. And then that helped me to see the value and beyond, which is part of the human aspect. And the other element was, of course, we're all grieving. We all lost our truth. I would now expect us to deal with it. We are a medical organization. We got a professional psychology crisis team sent to deal with this. No one spoke about it. Like, we all listened to that course. We were there. We nodded. We probably learned a thing or two, most of us. And then we were just back.
This was everyone, Afghans, the Westerners, the internationals.
The Westerners mainly I'm talking about now.
Okay, okay.
And then we were working too much. Some people were, you know, drinking or escaping or doing whatever you can do on that side of life, or just overtraining and not talking, going silent, right? And I was like, why? This is weird. I remember finding the documentary Human on YouTube, which is an incredible documentary, right? Open on YouTube. And I wanted to try to watch it quite close to this event. I tried to watch it 5 times. I didn't get over the first 5 minutes. Quite a rough start to that documentary, but it's an emotional start to the documentary, but it's very linked to Human. And I realized that I am not okay. Why am I not talking about it? Why is no one else talking about it? And I had that thought, finished my mission, the next 9 months go, I do great job, happy, come home to Norway, do another mission with refugees in Turkey and Greece, and I kind of see the situation
with the Syrians,
with the Afghans, with all kinds of people. And then again, thinking about this again, just processing it in my subconscious mind, but still now on the path of making a career in Doctors Without Borders. And then suddenly things change again, and I come out on the other side of this, and I'm like, why isn't it anything in between? Psychologist and nothing. This is the problem. I felt like there was nowhere to go. I'm not going to talk to a psychologist about this. Like, I don't even know what to say. I don't even have the words. Similar to when I was 13, even though I've evolved and I'm close to 30 now, but still. And then I realized, combining the documentary, the inspiration from there, Humans of New York, another channel that I enjoyed at the time, I was starting to say to myself, like, why don't we make a place where we can learn from the experiences that we have had, the power of experience? And then I was like, we can call it the human aspect. Because for me, as I said, I connected with my best friend when I was 13, and he was probably a major reason for why I survived. We connected over the fact that we had the same situation with our dad. Other than that, we were completely different. I remember the first time I met him, it was his mom that kind of forced a mom's friend that we had to play with him because he came to visit from outside. Man, we thought it was a complete schmuck, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He looked very different than us, had the big city mentality.
Yeah.
We were like, oh my God, like, we need to spend time with this kid. He turned into my best friend. So that showed me that in my mind, it didn't make sense that it was our DNA and environment that made up who we were. Because I had the same DNA as people around me. I said it's the environment, but I completely felt like an alien. But when I met him, instant connection. And that has happened many times after that in my life, obviously, where I have connected over something that has happened in life and what we have learned from that. And suddenly I was like, huh. So the human aspect for me is what makes us who we are through what we have gone through and what we brought from that. And then the next part of the human aspect was I need to make somewhere where that experience can be helpful for people when they don't want to go to a psychologist or they're not ready yet or they don't have access to one, right? So I was like, okay, how are we going to do that? I was like, we need to interview people and I'll find these people, I guess. So I went on the streets in Oslo. Again, I'm a person who do and then think later. We were there for like 1.5 weeks, grabbed a friend who could help me film. And we filmed 20 people on the street. Again, very typical me of being able to do that. So I managed to convince people to talk about their life's toughest challenge and how they have dealt with it to something they've never heard about, to a person they've never spoken to in their life. This is very typical.
And how long was each conversation, each of these 20 conversations, roughly?
Close to 20 minutes,
okay.
Probably.
Okay.
Yeah, 20 to maximum 30 minutes at the time. They were shorter than they are now. And then I sent this to a friend or to a lot of friends to get feedback, right? And we were like, is this worth our time or is this just not? And I remember one friend replied to me and he said in an email, is this a joke? I was like, I got offended. I was like, called him up. What do you mean this is a joke? He's a journalist. And he said, have you interviewed your cousin and you're pretending that you don't know him? I was like, no, you can see on the video clearly, like I'm stopping random on the street. He's like, this is incredible. I've never seen anyone open up like that to someone they don't know. You have to do something with this. And then he gave us 50 points of how bad the video was.
Yeah, okay.
And then all the things we need to improve. So we did that. Mm. And of course, I went on another mission for Doctors Without Borders. I was in limbo here now between those two things. But at the same time, I managed to convince a company here in Norway to build the library for free. They love the idea, a design container, fantastic company that was forward-leaning enough to join us in the beginning. And in 3 months, I had bought the domains. I had hustled and negotiated with a couple of peeps in the US that obviously had bought that a long time ago in the dot-com boom. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten this company to build it. I found an editor who made the videos. Like I basically Jimmy-styled this entire thing. And the 22nd of December, less than 3 months later, we launched the first life experience library in the world.
In the last part of our conversation, Jimmy talks about the history and the evolution of the human aspect. Because he went all in after he was interviewed by a Norwegian morning program, and that kind of just triggered or ignited. It kindled the passion and the motivation to go full throttle into the human aspect. Now, he's done over 750 plus interviews, and there are three major questions that are the DNA of each of these interviews. The first question is, what has been your life's toughest challenge? The second question, how have you managed to live with it or deal with it? And the third and probably most important question, what have you learned from that experience? Well, I hope you enjoy the rest of the interview. Jimmy, take it away.
But then I was interviewed by a morning show here in Norway, like the biggest morning show. And that kind of got me realizing that I have to do this all in. This feels right. Mm-hmm. It feels like this is what I'm supposed to do. So I convinced another friend of mine, best friend at the time, that do you want to join me in this, like, all in, let's try, build something out of this. She joined, and we kind of went straight into it, and we started attracting people in the same way I've always done in my life. I managed to kind of get people excited about things, and suddenly we were quite a nice bunch of people who was working on this, both the production in terms of the growing the company and all of that, or the foundation. And then it evolved so quickly from there. And every time we faced adversity in the sense of make it or break it, something happened. an opportunity arose that we created or took, you know, in the sense of a couple of big moments was in the first year, we almost like in the summer there after 6 months, we were like, we don't know how we're going to survive. I didn't have salary, obviously, at the time. So I was living off my old savings from the shipping times.
Yeah.
And my friend had to quit because she couldn't afford doing the same. That's very understandable at the time. And then we got at this similar to when she was starting to feel like it was getting too much. We got into a competition and we won it. It was an incubator. And suddenly we basically came out of nowhere as well. They like almost said that, we don't know if you can join. You're not really the fit profile. We were together with 10 other organizations and we won. And by a mile. Like, and then we got support, pro bono support, another boost, new people. Same story next year. We were struggling, didn't see how we would get forward. We didn't get yes on applications and stuff like that. And then the second time around, we were like, okay, we need to rethink this. Like, we're building products, in-depth video interviews with people on different topics. There are different organizations working on those topics with helplines or help services for people of that category. We are good at producing this content. They have the help. Let's call the organizations and ask if they want to donate to our organization to make more on their topic.
Yeah, yeah.
Success, right? Mm. And then we got another boost. And then suddenly we were in the office of Meta, Facebook. And I remember having the head of marketing with me there, a young, brilliant young man, Ymir, into that meeting. And when he came out, he was like, I don't even know how this happened. Like, you went into this meeting, you didn't even know that they give out grants. And you leave this meeting with a huge grant, like in our world, like huge grant at the time.
Sure,
was like $40,000 or something. It's a big sum for us, but not in the greater scale of things. And he was like, how did that happen? And he was so curious about the ability to create enthusiasm. Mm. I was genuinely invested in believing in the idea. Same reason for why we won, of course, the competition was that my friend and I, we were genuinely invested and we believed in it. I think they saw that. And the same with the Meta people. They've supported us for many years now. And that's what they said. Like, they saw something in us. And then, of course, that the idea. They loved the idea. So we've had the same. And then COVID came. Of course, we've had plenty of challenge building a team and all of that. We could have spoken about in another episode. But the biggest challenge in all of this, of course, comes to stay alive in the sense of not having a salary. Like, everybody's savings just comes
surviving,
to an end.
Right? Surviving. Yeah.
I had to sell my apartment to stay alive and then suddenly be back on couches and things like that. But, you know, everything you want to do if you believe in it. And then came COVID and we were like, okay, what do we need to do? We asked our team. We said, okay, we can step down like everybody else is doing, or we can step up. Now people will need us more than ever. That is clear. This is an opportunity to support people and show why we're important. Again, like in Afghanistan, 100% said yes. They were willing to go down a little bit on their salaries and things to make things work. They were willing to put in extra effort. And we went ahead and we also created a new income source, which was, of course, big workshops and talks for companies. I have done that a little bit on the side to stay alive as a private person. But then I realized production team, my competency, everybody would need this digital now because they're at home. Mm. Bang. And we basically cooed the market in Norway for digital mental health talks and Europe as well. Suddenly we had huge clients, the biggest in the country and in Europe.
Well, in a lot of cases, COVID, and we always talk about the negative, but for a lot of people, a lot of organizations, COVID has been a good thing because it's reshaped the story. It is... Yep. Shake up the landscape, and now we can plant what we want on this map. And in a sense, the human aspect did that. And it was kind of this confluence of the pandemic and the mental health issues that everyone's feeling, because it has created trauma. As I said before, I've worked with trauma to some extent, and we're coming out of this post-trauma, but your organization feeds into the narrative of post-traumatic growth and not always the stress aspect of it. So I think that was a very important point you made. I just wanted to kind of stamp that there.
Completely agree. And from the beginning, we had post-traumatic growth as one of our leading stars, right? Meaning, as you say, that you can bring something valuable out of trauma. And that's what the human aspect stands for, right? The third question, like the first question is, what has been your life's toughest challenge? And we go deep. Our interviews today are 30 to 60 minutes long, so we're not playing around. And they're considered to be therapeutic tools in itself. The video, it can help a person to deal with it better or a next of kin to support better. Question two, how have you managed to learn to live with it and or deal with it? Some things you just have to live with, like losing a child or something like that, right? And the last question, what have you learned? Post-traumatic growth, right? And what I found in the beginning was that very few had ever asked themselves that question. So my TED talk, when I gave that back in the day, it was actually around that. I said only 7% of the 400 at the time that I had interviewed, now it's like 750, had ever asked themselves that question. And then I made the talk around, why don't we? Because we're so eager to run away from our traumas when they're finished because we see it as negative. As something bad, as
something
an
broken,
anchor.
Something part of me that I don't want.
Exactly,
I've moved on.
Weak.
Well, that's, you know, a lot of time. That's bullshit, right? Because we haven't moved on. Sometimes we haven't processed those emotions. We haven't understood, and it comes back. And again, I've seen this time and time again, just from my own experience with other people. It comes back. It bites you in the ass at some point, unless it's addressed. And I guess that comes back to the point you made about in Afghanistan when the hospital was bombed. Sorry, nobody was processing it. They went to alcohol or they worked out excessively or they just bottled it up or what have you. Yep. And so we come full circle now back to the human aspect and the interview questions.
And the whole point was we are so eager to leave it behind us that we forget the most important thing that could have made the whole thing worth it. The lessons, the new abilities, the new skill sets. For the ones that are known with one of the most known personality tests in the world, the VIA strength test, like it's from this famous institute, and also the core strengths test from Gallup as well, Institute. Both of them have one thing that they can say can change your results. In theory, those tests are so smart that if you take them 5 years, 10 years apart, it will be plus minus the same results, as long as one thing hasn't happened. And that is a severe traumatic event. That's the only thing that can change your personality. So that was the whole point. Like these traumatic events that I'm asking people about has changed their personality. They have brought something out of it that they didn't have if they didn't meet it. I wouldn't have been the person I am today if I didn't have that father, if I didn't have that grandfather, if I didn't have the challenges that I had. I couldn't have been here. So that suddenly was kind of what we were pushing out as a message, but also then showing people that, okay, here is a normal human being you can learn from. And it's open 24/7. It's available everywhere. And you can look at it to find strength in either seeking help if you feel you need it, talk to the ones around you, utilize your own network, and or deal with it yourself in a healthier way.
And I think those stories, you know, those stories allow people to relate because when something happens to us, the first question is, why is this happening to me? Why has whatever the fates have chosen me? But I think part of it is what it does, it creates context, it broadens the perspective, and it normalizes the situation. Not normalizing trauma, but other people have gone through this. Yeah. But back to your question, how would you learn from this? Then we can start to reappraise. We can make meaning. We can make sense of it. And once we make sense of it, that allows us to move on.
And heal.
But I think what you're also saying, how the trauma affects personality, how that shifts personality. Well, that comes back to nerd out a little here. It comes back down to neuroplasticity, how experiences actually literally at a cellular level reshape the brain. Yep. And if we take only a negative experience on it and we become, as you said, the victim mindset, then our brains will adapt and bend the knee to that, and that's what we will become. But as you have done through multiple experiences or these people in the stories, these 750 plus people, they've taken it, reaffirmed it, reshaped it, and that becomes a mental habit. That becomes their default. And they're no longer the victims. They are actually, something happened to them, but they become a victor. they've Survivor, learned to make sense of it. I just wanted to put that in place because I think it's such a salient point that you've made.
It's absolutely correct. You force your brain to make new connections, right? Mm. Because suddenly your brain, in the same way I did all those jobs that I probably wasn't competent enough to do, right?
Yeah, sure.
It forces you to have to make new skills. You're literally outside the entire box, not just with a toe or a leg. You're like, your whole you is outside
the box. Well said, well said. Sometimes we have to embrace the struggle. We have to embrace experience because, again, repeatedly through this adventure that you call your life, each of these experiences, as tough as they were, they shaped you.
100%.
They gave you a punch in the gut sometimes, but it's made you a stronger individual, psychologically, cognitively, what have you.
And more experienced as well, to put a more neutral word to it, right? So that as well kind of led us then to make what is today the biggest income source. And the reason why we got through those 2 years in growth is because we suddenly now could supply companies with something that was a product. It was the first actual full-on product we had where we competed fairly with other organizations. Before that, we didn't really have a competitor because we were delivering something that didn't exist in the world. But now we moved into a space where there's a lot of people delivering great talks and workshops and things to companies, right? And suddenly, again, we were doing good because we delivered it differently with a different message, with this message, what we're talking about now. Companies started seeing that once we were there, they saw a different mentality. People weren't scared of mental health anymore. They were suddenly curious and they were like, okay, maybe Jimmy's got a point, because I used my own story, obviously, quite heavily in these talks. And they saw like a shift of mindset, which brings us back to the vision of the human aspect, which is to redefine mental health. Because to many people, mental health is something that we all have, but something that only the neighbor has, right? Your mental health is great, but you've heard about a person or two that lost it. But mental health, like health, is something we all have. And in the same way we should go to the gym and eat healthy to take care of our health, we should do the same with our mental health. But also, in the same way as you go to the gym to nerd out, basically destroy your muscle fibers to rebuild them in a stronger way, you need to face adversity and challenges to destroy the connections in your mind and the belief systems in ways that I've talked about.
Well, it's just the same thing. Like, it's so well said. Because, I mean, you have physical stamina, physical strength, and physical flexibility. Well, those stamina, we need mental stamina to pursue and have that tenacity move through. We need the mental strength and the fortitude to batter adversity. And we need the mental flexibility to be able to adapt to and evolve to ever-changing situations. And I think, you know, we can't get any much bigger than the pandemic. Societies, individuals, families, organizations, and thus the human aspect has contributed to that adaptation, that flexibility, and that stamina.
Yep, and we need to learn, which has kind of become the most popular word that I'm using now, we need to learn to just accept to be in a situation that we're not able there and then to cope with. And there's something about that space that's interesting. So in the same way as in Afghanistan and in the other job where I was in literally in a situation where I knew I don't have control, like I don't have the skill sets right now to deal with this job. But I just allowed that to be. I didn't have the need to control it. And once you dare to be in that space, that's where you challenge your mind and body to grow, right? But fast, in a sense, because you don't have a choice. In the same way as if you were in a crisis situation, you would do things you could have never seen yourself do, right? Because you have to. This is what is within us. This is like the secret power of a human and an animal, for that matter, where it's survival to survive, basically, and to adapt, right? So this is where it got very interesting, where I started training that and being like, okay, how can we now just stand in this adverse situation and not let it overpower you and just say, right now, I don't have the skill sets to deal with this situation, but I will trust that eventually during the coming days or weeks or months, for however long I need to stand in it, I will have those abilities. that creates that space to grow, where your mind doesn't panic and where you don't get anxiety. And suddenly I get to a little bit the nickname that I've been called sometimes.
Okay. Which is?
Of someone that is known to be calm in chaos. And it's not because I don't see the stress factors or don't acknowledge them or don't know that they're there. It's not because I'm emotionless. It's because I just observe and I don't give them power. And then I focus on what can I do right now? And I trust that eventually I will deal with this.
I think just to talk about that, you know, when you're in the midst of a maelstrom, it's, you know, there's the eye of the storm, the eye of the maelstrom that we can all shift. And a lot of it's the ability, that's why experience is so important, because it can teach us, it is the crucible in which we can refine our mental stamina and our experience. And then we become better adapting because we can say, this is how it played out before and this is how I shifted. And so as you were saying, you're almost becoming comfortable in the discomfort.
I almost enjoy it because it's more interesting than not having it like that, right? But also, again, when you try a difficult situation and you learn that, this went well, I managed. You were scared in the beginning, but then the result was good. Then you start getting comfortable in that as well. So I've started having so many of these situations in my life at one point. So I was like, it will be okay eventually. And then that brings us back to the power of normal faith. I'm not a religious person. I'm like more linked to like calling it the universe, right? But I have a lot of religious friends that has gotten a lot of positive power out of that because they have the same kind of belief that it will work out the way it's supposed to. And that's the same kind of psychological effects that I've seen in my own mindset, that I've allowed challenges to unfold without them impacting me fully. Of course, I'm a human being, so I will be impacted. I will be stressed like any other, but maybe less than what is considered to be normal, which makes it easier for me to rise to the occasion or easier for me to see the solutions. Because if you're very stressed, your own mind is very stressed, which is what I've seen in many of these 750 people I've interviewed as well. Is that once they allowed themselves to accept the situation as it was, not try to sugarcoat it like I did with mine when I told my parents, and when they have dared to be vulnerable in it and say, this is impacting me. Like, this is a shitty day. As you said, like the stars and plants and everything aligned to make a shitty day for me right now. But that's okay. And trusting that in the same way, they will align for me to get out of it.
And I think to cross that threshold, it sounds quite simple, but it takes time to process that, to come to that reasoning. And I think another thing what I hear, and that comes back to the interview questions you have. Yeah, there was three questions, and one of them is, what did you learn from it? Regardless of the question, but what they all have in common is how you engineer those questions. Because you can ask yourself stupid, disempowering questions and come up with answers. Your brain will come up with that. So the quality of the question. So we need to be cognizant. We need to be aware of how we articulate questions to ourselves that empower us, right? Not to fill us with positive thoughts, because sometimes it's a shitty situation. Any way you cut it, it's shitty. But the question is, constructively, how do I move through this maelstrom? How do I find myself in the eye of the storm where it's calm so I can gather and move through? And again and again and again, it comes down to the quality of questions we ask ourselves, because our brains will answer whatever question
is there.
We just need to know what questions we're asking ourselves.
And as you said, if you're in a maelstrom, sometimes you just need to relax, right? Because if you start trying to swing up the stream, which is what most of us will do, you'll get tired. So sometimes you just need to relax, start looking around on the banks of the river and look for, how can I get out of this? Not thinking that if I relax, I will die, which is what most people, that's why we're swimming upstream, right?
I remember my father used to say, he goes, Jason, you can walk into the ocean. And he's a Chinese guy, so we can go with the old stereotype, the old white Chinese guy. But anyways, so you walk into the ocean and then the wave batters you down, and then you can think you're stuffed and you get up and it batters you down again. I can deal with it. And you stand up again. And he goes, Jason, think a little, move back up the beach a little, so it's just rolling over your feet, and then you can go back, right? And so it's the same thing you're saying. So I see the connections.
Yep, exactly. And that's what helped me to realize that things that cause frustration. I haven't fully mastered it yet, but I'm working on it. But I think I'm quite aware of it. Normally, isn't necessarily serving you well. So if you're pushing an angle or a direction or a solution, and it, like universe or whoever, is clearly telling you this ain't the way because there's too much problems here, then start looking around, right? And trying that. And sometimes the solution is difficult. And that's where you realize where you can just trust that process and be, okay, this is shitty, this is frustrating, this is not working out the way I wanted to, but I still believe, because I've looked around, that this is the best way out of this tough challenge. Then you have to just stand in it and continue. And this is where, you know, you would then just carry on into the waves and moving that inch at a time and then eventually pop out on the other side. But you, that shouldn't be your first option. Which it normally is for a lot of us, at least our stubborn-headed peeps like us, normally like push forward, right?
Yes, yes. Well, so, Jimmy, I'm really respectful of your time. You know, the human aspect is just that. You've filmed 700-plus videos. It is to help people to gain context, to normalize their situation, to know that other people have come through the storm, that they too can. And that could be the one thing that pulls them from that dark space into a living space.
Or get them to think.
Yeah, and get them to think, to reflect, and you've categorized it into different things. I will include all the contact information and such, but one last question to you, and this brings you back to the man behind the organization. I was wondering if a teenager, if not anyone, is in a dark space right now.
Yep.
What advice would you give to them? Because when you're in the dark space, you think this is going to last and stretch on forever, but they're everything, this too shall pass, but it's hard to get that. Like, your parents and people around you said, Jimmy, everything will be better. But you couldn't accept that. But being the voice, you know, your voice is going into their ears right now. Maybe they're lying on the couch, what have you, walking their dog. What would you say to them? What would one or two pieces of advice you would help those people in that dark space to come out?
Number one is to, of course, dare to say the situation out loud to yourself. Either if you're artistic, draw it. If you like to write, write it. Like, typically write the situation down, pros and cons, why is it difficult? Those standard questions you can ask yourself. Or just say it out loud, record it. This is a modern world. You can record a video. It's up to you. And then allow yourself to read, listen, or watch that. And then see what happens now. Like, because it is strange to say, but something happened inside your head and outside your head is two different things, because it adds perspective.
Well said. Mm.
So suddenly, once you just put it out there, like into the world, not sharing it with anyone at this point, it might change the way you look at it. Just that. So that's probably a good step one that has helped me many times. And then the other part is to look at the same situation and the stereotypical classical thing. Think, what would you have said to a friend if this was their situation? Like, give yourself advice. But what you're actually doing, to nerd on it again, is you put yourself literally in another mindset. Because if you're in the mindset of, oh, how do I get out of this situation? Your mind can close itself down. If you now be like, okay, this is a situation of a friend. Let me entertain this silly task of doing that, because it's not real, right? Suddenly your mind changes where it's active in your mind. And you're literally accessing parts of your mind that maybe is not accessible for you right now. And then you might come up with things that you wouldn't have if you said, okay, how do I help myself? Again, the quality of the questions. You basically trick your own mind to helping you out. If that doesn't work, there are certain elements that will help you to access other parts of your mind. Number one, fresh air, always been useful. Number two, change perspective. If your mind is like rumbling around about the same thing over and over and over and over again, which my mind has done many times in these tough situations, going somewhere where your mind is taking into the present is very helpful. If our minds is in the future, we get anxiety. We're fearful of things. If our mind is in the past, we can become a victim, we become shameful, we can become angry. Mm-hmm. So problematic emotions that normally makes it difficult to be solution-oriented mm-hmm. lies in the past and the present, or the past and the future. But once you can reconnect with the present, like one of the people we just interviewed, that was a fantastic person who was a hardcore drug addict for many years. He said that the second he actually dared to ask himself, how am I doing right now? He was in the middle of the recovery process. He hated his life, to be honest about that. But he was walking his dog. It was a beautiful day. And he was by chance sitting by a lake. And he asked himself, like, how am I doing like right now at this moment? And he was like, it's a fantastic view. I have this silly, foolish dog here that I enjoy. And I'm out in the free.
Dogs are always good. Yeah.
So at that moment, his truth was, right now, I'm actually doing great. So just introducing great as an option in a life where you don't see any hope is quite interesting. Because our mind works in a very fascinating way. If I give you 100 options and one of those options is positive, now your truth that everything is hopeless is broken. You just need one proof.
Put a crack in the belief.
Exactly. Know? And then it's not going to happen fast. Mm. But that small example that you, even in this shitty life that you have right now, and maybe I can't help any of those things that you're in. Like, as we said, sometimes life is just shit. But if you can introduce that even in this shitty life, you might actually have a good conversation with a friend. You might actually have a positive thing happen to you, or you might actually have the same experience as him sitting by a lake with a dog. And by chance, it's sunny that day. It happens even in Norway, right? That sun comes out.
Yeah, and I just, because I think those are three skills that they're so salient and they're so useful. And just to put my kind of spin on it, the first one is like, you know, as you said, write it out, draw it out. The reason is, folks, is that when you do that, you take abstract thoughts and emotions and you articulate into things tangible, things that you can see. So if you don't like the color of the drawing, change it. If you don't like the words, change it. That gives you objectivity. The second one where you said, you know, talk to a friend, like someone's with a friend. Yes, again, that'll put you in a mindset of very good things because that'll move you from the subjective to the objective. But what it also allows on top of that is self-compassion. Because sometimes we will show compassion to everyone else, but for ourselves, we're in a fetal position, so we give ourselves another boot in the head. But like I'm talking to you now, Jimmy, across the table, I can show compassion if put Jason there, and then I can show self-compassion. And I think the third one is so important. It's the get outside your bubble, get outside your head, go for a walk, go for a run, get fresh air. Because the physiology, when we're moving, that opens up the psychology, and that opens up the possibility just to see one thing that can be that little thread that pulls us from that dark place, or at least down the road to a better place. So I just want to put that into context because I think all those three skills are so important. And again, I think that's so important to be able to teach this to kids, to teenagers, to young adults, to old alike, whether you're 9 or 99. These are the things that we can have. These are tools that have worked for other people, and they will work with you, a combination or what have you.
Yep.
So thank you very much for sharing those skills because I think that just this conversation, man, this could be pulling someone out of a dark place.
Thank you. And of course, to over-nerd about it, just moving will help your mind to get less cloudy. You'll hear, like, your depressional symptoms will literally go down. Your anxiety symptoms will literally go down. We're talking about hormones and
magic of the body's chemistry. Yeah, exactly.
So that's why that is crucial, that last part, to test it out, because it will literally make it easier for your mind to do the first two things as well that we spoke about. So take a walk before you do the first two things. And eventually, like, the two biggest points I would want to make.
Sure, please.
Is number one, I was forced to stop by the accident with my back. That's the first time I ask myself the questions, who are you when you strip yourself of the contexts, the narratives of the others? When I wasn't the sports person, where I wasn't the guy, young guy talented in shipping, where I wasn't a brother or a sister because I was alone in Singapore, right? That's where I realized and went deep enough to ask myself, what am I actually good at? What have I been good at since, you know, I was playing around in the sandbox? And that's where I kind of put many of the pieces together that it sounds like I'm so cleverly talking about now, which was, of course, I've always been able to get people excited, enthusiastic, and lead people, and I enjoy it. I have always been kind and empathic and in contact with that feminine side of myself. But I've also been very tough in the terms of mentality of pushing forward and being able to do long-term goals. And suddenly I was like, I will be okay, right? I realized I had the three pillars to understand that if I lose my job, I'll find a new one. If I don't be able to do sports again, I will find somewhere else where I can compete and do things. Like, I literally came to the point where I realized self-value, right? It was the first time in my life I probably felt I had self-worth at any level and that I had thought about it. And this is a good way for you as well, if you're lying there and having a tough time, to dare to strip yourself of the context of who people say you are, the labels, and see what is left in there. Like, who are you? Because we all have values and elements of ourselves, no matter how low we are, that actually is at least neutral, a-okay. And then, of course, the last point is dare to stand in the situation you are now, this stream, and just stop fighting it and look around. Are there other options you haven't thought about? Are you smothering the situation yourself? Are you lying to your family like I did and not saying what is really going on? Are you not allowing your friends to help you because you're always answering the question, how are you with, I'm great or I'm okay? And then suddenly you might see options that you haven't seen. And if you're curious, of course, in the human aspect, you have 750 people that can help you to come up with suggestions of what you can try in your own life without any judgment or without any point.
Well, I think the human aspect, to put a cap on this, is one of the most important foundations and organizations to help people deal with their situation. And it gives context, and these are real life experiences, and you can watch it. So you don't have to read volumes and volumes of a book. It's there and it's present, and it's always there, whether it's on your phone, your tablet, your computer. Again, Jimmy, respectively, time, I really appreciate you sharing your experience, your vulnerability, and hopefully some of the words, our conversation, will help someone out of a dark place, even if it's just a first step down a long road. So I thank you, brother, for your time and, well, the good conversation. The coffee wasn't bad.
Thank you so much. It was a brilliant conversation for me as well. I'm very grateful we had it.
All right, Jimmy, you have a good one now. We'll talk soon.
Talk soon.
Well, another big thank you to Jimmy Westerheim. He is the CEO and founder of The Human Aspect. You know, Jimmy, I really appreciate your vulnerability, your time, your experience, and sharing your knowledge and your story with us. There was so much to gain. And dear listener, I know this was a marathon interview, and maybe you absorbed it in parts, or maybe you had it in one sitting and you walked that dog for 2 hours, or you went for a long run or bike ride, whatever works. Because rather you digested this in parts or in one long stream, I know you will pull something from this. Please share it with someone you think it may help. It might give some insight or even pull someone back from the abyss, because there's a lot of knowledge and experience that is actionable and practical. You know, all of it is not, this is not textbook knowledge, folks. This is experienced knowledge, and Jimmy brings it from a host of different areas and different places of life. You know, this was a really great conversation for me, and I connected with Jimmy on so many levels that, well, 2 hours is what this interview turned out to be. And there was a lot more to gain, but that will have to be a part two at some point in the future. So again, thanks, Jimmy. I really appreciate your time and your openness. Well, folks, that brings us to an end of another amazing episode and interview. And I hope you learned a lot, as I said. As usual, if you could please rate, share, score this podcast with others, it's to continue the conversation and hopefully bring more listeners to this medium. Anyways, folks, that's it for this week. I appreciate your time. Until next week, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon.